Hello, it's Tuesday, the 14th of December, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The number of critically ill COVID-19 patients has reached another new high. Meanwhile, the recently expanded vaccine pass system experienced technical glitches for a second day. We'll have more in our news briefing shortly. President Moon Jae-in is on a state visit to Australia, the first by a Korean leader in 12 years. We'll take a look at the history and future of the relationship in our in-depth today. And then coming up on Touch Base in Seoul, we talk to a young pianist who made it to the final round of the prestigious Chopin piano competition. We'll learn about his story and his goals as a musician. Let's begin Korea 24. The number of severe COVID-19 cases has reached a new high, hitting 906 cases. Health authorities say they are concerned with this rising trend, warning if it continues, it could begin limiting ICU access to patients with non-COVID symptoms. For more on this and other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio News Editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hi, Jang-woo.
Okay, so Eunice, can you tell us some more about these concerns on how intensive care units at hospitals could be affected as the number of critically ill COVID-19 patients grow?
Yeah, absolutely. These comments came from a senior official at the Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures Headquarters that is under the Health Ministry. Park Hyung, during an online Tuesday briefing, said that if critically ill COVID-19 patients surpass the 1,000 mark, more ICU beds will need to be secured for them, which then could seriously impact other ICU patients. And we are inching closer to that 1,000 mark. The KDCA said the number of severe cases rose to a new record on Tuesday to 906 after remaining in the 800s for six straight days. Park Hyung said 40-50% of ICU beds at hospitals nationwide are already being used for COVID-19 patients. She cited slowing the pace of severe cases as a priority, and two impediments to that end were breakthrough cases among the elderly, which is being addressed with the ongoing booster shot campaign, and also the virus spread among the unvaccinated. She said although 8% of the adult population are yet vaccinated, the unvaccinated do account for over 51% of severe cases and nearly 54% of deaths.
On that note, can you run us through where we are in our daily COVID figures as authorities monitor the situation?
Yeah, we did add 30 more critically ill patients throughout Monday to reach 906. As we mentioned, we also reached a fresh high in the number of people who died of the coronavirus at 94, which is 54 more than the day earlier and 14 more than the previous record, which was registered on Saturday. As far as overall cases are concerned, the KDCA reported 5,567 throughout Monday, of which 34 cases were overseas transmissions. The capital region accounted for about 70% of local cases, and the number of confirmed Omicron infections rose by 5 to 119. Meanwhile, Senior Presidential Secretary for Public Communication, Park Soo-hyun, on a radio program earlier on Tuesday, said relevant preparations have been completed and officials will monitor until Wednesday or Thursday before it selects appropriate COVID-19 curbing measures. He added the government won't be indecisive in such a serious situation and said the prepared steps will take both social distancing and its impact on the people's livelihoods into account.
Meanwhile, despite efforts to fix the problem, there were still reports of glitches in accessing the KOOV app on this second day of the expanded vaccine pass system.
Right. There were disruptions reported around the peak hours of lunchtime once again as people were not able to pull up the QR code showing their vaccination or PCR test status. Health officials say they will not be issuing penalties on cases where vaccination status could not be checked upon entry to a restaurant or a cafe due to a system failure for the time being. So it seems we'll be in a bit of an adaptation stage, Chang-ho, as was the case with mask supply and vaccinations, if you'll remember, early on in the pandemic. The KDCA did say that it took emergency steps to mitigate network errors in the CoV vaccination authentication app on Monday, adding on new servers and also optimizing service overnight.
Now, among the people in line for a COVID-19 test today was none other than the ruling Democratic Party's presidential candidate, Lee Jae-myung. Can you tell us about this?
Right. So this was a proactive preventative step, according to Lee Jae-myung's camp, who said while the DP presidential candidate was on tour of Daegu and North Gyeongsang province over the weekend, he came within a 1 meter distance of someone who later was confirmed to have contracted COVID-19. The DP's election committee said Lee did not come into direct contact with that confirmed patient, but had exchanged greetings again at that 1 meter distance. So Lee canceled all appointments set for Tuesday, including a visit to the Hyundai Research Institute to discuss economic policies, as the camp was not sure when he would actually be able to get tested. We've mentioned the very long lines and also when the results would be received. His wife, who was also on the campaign trail with him over the weekend, received a test as well.
Staying on news related to the presidential race, the wife of the main opposition People Power Party's presidential candidate, Yoon Sung-yeol, has reportedly recognized that she falsely claimed an award while applying for a visiting professor position in 2007.
Right. This is based on broadcaster YTN, who reported an exclusive 30-minute interview with Kim Gon-hee after checking on past work experiences claimed on an old resume of hers. It asked Kim about her listing a top award at the 2004 Seoul International Cartoon and Animation Festival. On her resume, Kim reportedly replied that she wanted to stand out in the hiring process, and if that is a sin, that is a sin. YTN confirmed through festival organizers that there was no entry at the time under Kim's former name, which is Kim Myung-shin, and as for claiming on her resume that she had worked as a senior executive at the Korea Association of Game Industry from the years 2002 to 2005, when the association itself was only established in 2004, Kim said that she is currently checking on the facts.
Let's turn to other headlines now. North Korea's state media said regime leader Kim Jong-un reaffirmed his will to adhere to the self-reliance ideology passed down from his predecessors. Can you tell us more?
Yes, and of course, by predecessors, we are referring to the late founder of North Korea and Kim Jong-un's grandfather, Kim Il-sung, as well as his late father, Kim Jong-il. Now, according to the state newspaper, Rodong Shinmun, on Tuesday, the young leader made the reaffirmation to adhere to the self-reliance ideology ahead of the 10-year anniversary of his leadership. According to the paper, Kim said, "Walk the same path forever" is his ideology and desire, although it did not elaborate when and where such remarks were made. The paper said Kim's honorable achievement is transcending the revolution's basis and victory by upholding such ideology. It also quoted Kim's remark made months after a no-deal summit with former U.S. President Donald Trump in Hanoi in 2019 that his resolution on defending the outcome of the revolution is becoming more steadfast.
Now, in a follow-up to a headline from Monday, Japan now says a clear assessment will be needed on whether South Korea meets the conditions to join the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the CPTPP.
Right. We shared yesterday the South Korean government officially announced its intent to begin the application process to join the CPTPP, which China and Taiwan also applied for membership in September. Japan is the current chair of the CPTPP, and Tokyo's chief cabinet secretary, Hirokazu Matsuno, on Tuesday said Japan will have to see if Seoul meets the high standards to join the pact. He said the CPTPP maintains high standards in various areas, such as market accessibility, e-commerce, and government procurement. He added no bilateral talks have been held on the issue and no talks are planned at this point.
Over to Australia next, where President Moon Jae-in has met with its opposition leader on Tuesday in Sydney. So what did the two discuss?
So the president met with Anthony Albanese of the Labor Party, and the two discussed various issues of mutual interest and ways to build lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. He told Albanese that he looks to boost bilateral cooperation in various future industries through elevated strategic partnership, marking 60 years of diplomatic ties, as he also expressed gratitude for Canberra's support for Seoul's peace process efforts. He also asked for continued cooperation on that matter in the future. Meanwhile, the main opposition leader, Albanese, conveyed respect for Seoul's unyielding efforts in fostering peace in the region and that he fully supports peace and the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The two shared policy ideas that pursue renewable energy as well, while ensuring that the laborers' livelihoods are also upheld. They discussed ways to boost cooperation in technologies needed to reach carbon neutrality.
And finally, there was a sizable earthquake that rattled parts of Jeju Island late this afternoon. What do we know about it so far?
Yes, details are still forthcoming, but according to the KMA, the magnitude 4.9 quake was reported about 41 kilometers west-southwest of southern Jeju city of Seogwipo at 5:19 p.m. The depth of the epicenter was estimated to be at 17 kilometers. It is being characterized as the strongest quake yet on the Korean Peninsula for this year, which only saw 4 of 64 quakes this year exceed magnitude 3 on the Richter scale. Early reports had people on the island say they've never felt such a powerful quake, adding the tremors continued for a good 10 seconds. Authorities are investigating the extent of the damage from the quake, if there are any.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
You bet.
South Korea and Australia celebrated 60 years of diplomatic relations this year. Coinciding with that, President Moon Jae-in embarked on a state visit to Australia on Sunday, the first by a South Korean president in 12 years. He held summit talks with Prime Minister Scott Morrison in Canberra on Monday, where the two sides agreed to upgrade the country's bilateral ties to a comprehensive strategic partnership. To assess the current state of the relationship between the two Asia-Pacific powers and their future, particularly with one eye on China, we have joining us on the line now Ms. Hayley Channa, Senior Policy Fellow at the Perth US Asia Centre in Australia. Ms. Channa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be a part of it.
Now, as I mentioned, this year marks the 60th anniversary of diplomatic relations between South Korea and Australia. Looking back at those 60 years, Ms. Channa, how would you summarise the history of the relationship?
Well, look, the Australia-South Korea relationship has been a very happy and positive one, but I think over 60 years, it's really been underappreciated on both sides and also underutilised. So if you think about it, Australian troops fought side by side with South Korean troops during the Korean War. But apart from that shared history and our strong trade relationship, we've never really looked across the table at one another and seen each other as a bigger partner in a strategic sense. We have very strong people-to-people links, but I think on the political side and the strategic side, we have had a much more potential to unpack in the relationship. And I think the fault really lies on both sides. On the South Korean side, it has necessarily been preoccupied with the Korean Peninsula and its own region. But even when Lee Myung-bak had a global Korea policy, that was really looking internationally and looking at working with multilateral institutions and not at looking at closer relations with Australia. And even South Korea's current new southern policy doesn't look as far south as Australia. And then similarly, Australia has really overlooked Korea in favour of the United States and other US allies and partners like Japan, India, the UK and Indonesia. But right now, I think we're finally at a new moment in the relationship where each country is finally looking across the table at the other and seeing the other country with new eyes. And partly the reason for that is a more complicated and challenging regional strategic environment.
Right. I think some might have been actually a bit surprised to learn that it was, in fact, the first time in 12 years that a South Korean president had made a state visit to Australia. So that perhaps highlights your point. Nevertheless, President Moon is in Australia now and is, in fact, the very first visit by a foreign leader on Australian soil since the pandemic began. During the summit talks with Prime Minister Morrison, the two leaders are said to have agreed to bolster defence and security cooperation, as well as partner in future industry areas related to carbon neutral technology and the hydrogen economy. The leaders also said they would work towards securing a stable supply of critical minerals, which Australia has in abundance. So that's the official line of what was discussed. But what would you say was the significance of Moon's state visit to Australia?
Well, first of all, we're really delighted to have a South Korean president visit. It has been far too long. And I think a lot of the time, both the Australian Prime Minister and South Korean president have met on the sidelines of major international dialogue rather than making the additional effort to actually visit each other's countries. So I would like to see a lot more state visits because I think that political relationships are where a lot of foreign and security policy is actually made these days. But in terms of how significant it is, well, the answer to that question is actually not in the visit itself, but in what both countries do after this visit in the years and decades ahead to actually fulfil some of the different cooperation pledges they've made. And so that's going to take commitments from successive governments over years to come. But in a really positive sense, I think we're actually at a place where the planets are finally aligning and Australia and South Korea both need each other for a secure and prosperous future, and each other provides a solution. So, for example, you mentioned the hydrogen economy, and that's a really good example. As Australia and Korea start to build deeper relations across a whole range of different domains, their emerging hydrogen partnership can really anchor their trade and investment relationship. So if you look at the current Australia-Korea LNG partnership, for instance, this partnership's underpinned by joint resources development, and a hydrogen partnership could build on this existing model. Korea needs to secure energy to sustain its industry, and Australia needs to secure finance and long-term contracts to sustain large projects over decades. But the scale of cooperation needed to establish the hydrogen industry in the first place, that is absolutely massive. So it's really going to require a level of vision and ambition from Australia and Korea to make it work. Hmm. But what this means is we have a new opportunity to shape our bilateral relations for years to come and really set our economies up to be more sustainable in the future. So it's all positive from here.
Right, opportunities for win-win exchanges. Moon and Morrison, they also agreed to upgrade the country's bilateral ties to a, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership. What does that mean exactly?
Great question. I often wonder these things myself. what is a comprehensive strategic partnership? And particularly when Australia has a special strategic partnership with Japan, what does that actually mean? It's funny. Comprehensive strategic partnership means different things to different countries. For instance, China has a comprehensive strategic partnership with Australia, but that hasn't meant too much in terms of keeping our relationship with China on an even keel. In fact, it's probably at its worst state that it has been for decades. But when I think comprehensive strategic partnership, what I think that means is that all areas of the relationship are very strong and robust. So that was not just economic ties, but also people-to-people links, political ties, and critically, strategic cooperation. So on economic side, we have an extremely strong relationship. South Korea is Australia's fourth largest trading partner. In 2019, it accounted for 4.5% of Australia's total trade, a value of about $41 billion. And in terms of the people-to-people links, Australia is totally besotted with Korea. We love Korean culture, from K-pop to film to food. And this visit by President Moon is going to help bolster the political ties. But the strategic cooperation is really lacking. And I think that's because South Korea finds itself in a very difficult position, wedged as it is between China and the United States. But if you compare, for example, Australia's strategic relationship with Japan, you know, we fought against Japan in World War II, and yet we fought with Korea more recently in the Korean War. And you look at the two relationships and people scratch their heads and think, why isn't Australia a closer partner of South Korea? So if we were to have a really comprehensive strategic partnership, we need to be doing much more in a strategic sense.
You've mentioned the heightened tensions between Australia and China. That's really in the background to this visit by Moon. The situation, of course, reached its peak when recently Australia announced its new trilateral security partnership with the US and Britain, dubbed AUKUS, in an apparent attempt to counter China. Under the partnership, the US will help Australia build nuclear-powered submarines for the first time. For South Korea, although the US is its main ally, it maintains a close relationship with Beijing, as it is the country's biggest trade partner. So there are question marks about how Beijing would view Moon's trip to Australia at this time. With all that in mind, then, what does each side want out of Moon's visit here?
Well, I know that President Moon has been very careful to distance himself, in the Australian media at least, from any sense that his visit is in any way related to China. And I just wanted to address this whole question about AUKUS and is it because of China? The truth is that the whole Indo-Pacific region and countries in it have been modernising their militaries over decades. This comes after a lot of different countries have grown their economies. Naturally, then they also want to increase their defence and security forces, partly for national prestige, but also for security. And the reason that AUKUS was born is because of this more difficult, unstable Indo-Pacific environment. Now, that's not totally China's fault. However, China has been the most destabilizing actor. If you look at its territorial grabs in the South China Sea or how aggressive it is on its shared border with India, you look at some of the more dangerous maneuvers that it undertakes in the air and sea space in the South China Sea, added to its economic coercion, which has done to South Korea as well as Australia, and also its cyber attacks, and even its treatment of minorities inside of China, we're seeing China flex its muscles more than it ever has in recent times. And all countries in the region are really concerned about this. And Australia naturally is looking at ways to better position itself for this more uncertain future. And one of the ways that it sees it can do that is through nuclear-powered submarines, which are able to go much farther away from Australian shores and stay concealed for much longer time. I would say also that Australia is not trying to counter China. It's trying to constrain China's power. We would like a powerful and rich China. We just don't want it to destabilize the whole region. But AUKUS and South Korea are not related. What Australia would really like from its partnership with South Korea is for Seoul to use more of its leadership potential. You know, I think South Korea is such a huge power in its own right, and yet it naturally chooses not to use its influence to try and promote its values and interests more in the region. And so I'd like to see South Korea work much more closely with its partners in the region, because outside of the United States, South Korea really doesn't have a strong strategic partner, and Australia is really presenting itself as a key partner for South Korea and a natural partner, I believe.
AUKUS, as you said, isn't directly related to Korea, but something that is perhaps more related is the Australia's involvement in the Quad, which also Beijing views negatively, the quadrilateral dialogue, which includes the US again, Japan and India, and again another seen as another deterrence measure against China's military ascendancy in the Indo-Pacific region. What could be seen as Canberra's calls for Seoul's participation? Morrison said countries, including South Korea, should defend their sovereignty through partnerships if they are ever undermined within a region. What do you make of such comments by Morrison? And do you see South Korea getting involved in the Quad?
I think the comments related to the fact that China is quite a large and powerful country and it has the capacity to exert its influence over other countries, much smaller countries in the region. And I think that's a dangerous place to be in because it can create a lot of instability, a lot more inequality, and just create worse outcomes overall. What we need to remember about the Quad, though, is if you cast your mind all the way back to the early 2000s, the Quad first came out of a major regional disaster, the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. And what happened there was the four Quad countries realized as maritime nations that they had the capacity to assist other countries in the region with their disaster response and humanitarian relief. And then after that one catalyzing event, the four countries realized they had a lot of strategic interests in common, and generally they were worried about the trajectory of the region in terms of its militarization and a rising China. So for a long time, it was just strategic dialogue that the Quad had, and there was a lot of speculation that it was going to turn into a military alliance to counter China. What I think that we have seen this year, though, completely debunks that theory. The Quad has decided it's not going to be a hard military tool. It's going to be much more a soft power tool where the Quad countries are going to provide regional public goods. So we see that in terms of the Quad COVID vaccine pledge and also the Quad's activity in delivering critical technologies and also work on climate change. And so I don't see the Quad at all as a military counterweight to China. I see it as a means for those four countries to influence other countries in the region towards their values and way of doing business, which includes things like transparency and the rule of law. And I don't think that South Korea will ever become a member of the Quad. I don't think it's possible because, first of all, South Korea doesn't want to make that political statement because China sees the Quad as an anti-China initiative. And also because of South Korea-Japan tensions, I think it would be very difficult for South Korea to join. However, that doesn't mean that we can't do things collectively with South Korea. In fact, there are some incredible trilateral ideas that Australia and South Korea could explore, for instance, with Indonesia or India in a kind of Korea-Indonesia-Australia arrangement, which you could give a familiar Korean name, KIA. But I think some of those trilateral mechanisms would be a fantastic thing for South Korea to explore, so that it could venture out into minilateralism in the region and really promote its interests and values like other countries are doing.
We appreciate your thoughts. I want to get your thoughts on one more issue before we go quickly. This visit by Moon also comes as he continues to try and drum up international support for a declaration for the end of the Korean War and engage in dialogue with North Korea. Where does Australia stand on the peace process on the Korean Peninsula? And what role do you think Australia could play to help promote peace?
This is a fantastic question. And the first thing I want to say is that I'm so sorry that the Korean Peninsula is divided. I've been to the demilitarized zone twice, and seeing that place really reminds me how much of a scar the demilitarized zone is on the Korean Peninsula. The problem, I think, with the idea of a peace process and more generally reunification of the peninsula and also denuclearization of the peninsula is that North Korea and the current regime in North Korea doesn't see it as in its interest to do any of those things. And I think for as long as the Kim regime is in power, it will not want reunification in any way. And therefore, it's in Kim Jong-un's interest to continue the Korean War and not have a formal peace process. How can we counter this? I mean, one of the key ways is, I think, through economic development, so that you have a more empowered North Korean population that starts to ask a lot more of its government and starts to realise what conditions are like outside North Korea. I personally don't see a strong role that Australia can play other than promoting human rights and also dialogue and diplomacy. I know that President Moon and Prime Minister Morrison talked about that dialogue and diplomacy in their joint statement. But generally, you know, Australia would hugely welcome peace on the peninsula. I think, though, it will require a much longer-term discussion with the United States, Japan and China to try and bring that about. But anything that Australia can do to help South Korea's plight, we will be doing.
We'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Ms. Haley Channa from the Perth US Asia Centre. Thank you for your time today.
감사합니다.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 13.71 points or 0.46% on Tuesday, closing the day at 2,987.95. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 3.15 points or 0.31% to close at 1,002.81. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 1.81 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,182.6 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea today. And for that, we have Jung Yeon joining us in the studio. Yeon, hello. It's good to speak to you again.
Hello.
So what topics do you have for us today?
First, we'll talk about the UK's first recorded death of a patient with the Omicron COVID-19 variant strain. And next, we'll discuss presidential candidate Ho Kyung-young's PR phone call campaign affecting medical centers nationwide. And our last story is on South Korea's Netflix original series, Squid Game, earning 3 nominations for the 2022 Golden Globe Awards.
Okay, so we start off with an international story related to the pandemic, which of course has implications for South Korea and the rest of the world as well. Can you tell us more?
Yes, our first story is about the UK reporting its first death with the Omicron COVID-19 variant on Monday local time. During his visit to a local vaccination clinic yesterday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said in an interview that, quote, "the idea that this is somehow a milder version of the virus is something we need to set on one side and just recognize the sheer pace at which Omicron accelerates through the population."
Right, so this is the first confirmed death with the Omicron variant in the UK, but is it a global first?
Good question. So the European Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, ECDC, told global news agency AFP that this is the first confirmed case of death with the variant, but that it is impossible to ascertain whether it is a global first. As of yet, no other country has publicly confirmed deaths with Omicron, and Britain gave no specifics on the death other than that the person was diagnosed at the hospital. It isn't clear yet if the patient had been vaccinated or had underlying health problems, and before the death was announced, British health authorities announced that 10 patients ranging from 18 to 85 years of age were hospitalized due to Omicron and that most were breakthrough infections.
Right. Until now, because there had been no reported cases of deaths with the Omicron variant, there had been some hope that perhaps it could be a more mild variant of the COVID-19 virus, despite being more highly transmissible. But Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been quick to stress that with this death, we should not be taking the situation lightly.
Yes.
So what is the broader COVID-19 situation like in the UK currently?
On Monday local time, British Health Minister Sajid Javid said that the number of cases of Omicron variant increased by 1,576 from the previous day, totaling up to 4,713. Javid added that 44% of confirmed COVID-19 cases in London are Omicron infections and that the variant will become the dominant strain in the capital within 48 hours. Meanwhile, the British government has moved the deadline for booster shots to the end of this month, a month earlier than the original deadline. In addition, they have strengthened quarantine measures by making wearing masks indoors mandatory, recommending remote work, and requiring COVID passes for entry to large venues.
Yes, meanwhile, in South Korea, the latest Omicron count is at 119. No related deaths reported yet, but it is a situation that, of course, needs to be closely monitored.
Yes.
Okay, let's move on to our next story now. What do you have for us?
Our next story is on Ho Kyung-young, the South Korean politician and founder of the National Revolutionary Dividends Party, but more specifically of complaints on his presidential PR phone call campaign, as it has allegedly been affecting ER medical staff during their shifts. On Saturday, one such staffer directed an online post at Ho, claiming that they received his PR call on the ER hotline on a very busy day. Another took to social media to talk about how 10 out of 15 calls that rang through the intensive care unit within just 1 hour on a weekend afternoon was Ho's PR phone call campaign. Both posters stressed how annoying it was to receive these calls during their busy shifts.
Okay, before we explain a bit more about Ho, can you explain on what this call exactly is, Yeowon?
Yes, so this call is actually a 10-second voice message recorded by the candidate himself, and such calls have been connected to countless people in the country since early November to encourage voting in the presidential election. Some who answered the call have said that it was intriguing at first, but it's become very frustrating as it's been persisting for over a month now. Another said that they got a call even though they don't have voting rights, and some just resorted to blocking the number. Despite such efforts, the line's number has in fact been changed and the calls are still ongoing.
Right, so basically these are what in the US is called robocalls. Mm-hmm. At this point, we should point out that Ha is a very minor candidate, and there have been many words to describe him, should we say, such as a controversial, eccentric.
Yes.
Some would even label him as a cult leader.
Mm-hmm.
But because of this, because of his outlandish nature and policy pledges, he does attract quite a bit of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And his calls have become notorious as well. I myself have received such a call as well. But generally, he is dismissed by the wider public and his calls are considered generally a nuisance. Has candidate Ha acknowledged the public sentiment at all?
Well, though there hasn't been a direct response from him, the head of his party's public affairs office said this phone call campaign is because Ha is being neglected and not brought on broadcasted debates. So they're calling to change this behavior, and they also added that it is absolutely not illegal to collect personal information as they legally requested such data via a service company. And according to the National Election Commission, the phone call PR campaign does not violate the Public Official Election Act because it does not support or recommend a specific political party or candidate.
Okay, so within the legal limits, but the question of where he got the numbers as well remains.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's leave that there and move on to our final trending story. What do you have for us?
On Monday local time, the Hollywood Foreign Correspondents Association announced that the Korean-made Netflix original series Squid Game won 3 nominations for the 79th Golden Globe Awards, set to take place January 9th of next year.
Yes, I remember them winning the Gotham Awards just a few weeks back and the People's Choice Awards too, less than a week ago. It seems like the series is on quite the run. So can you tell us about the nominations then, Yeowon?
Of course. So the first category they've been nominated for is Best Television Series Drama. And they'll be competing with shows like Lupin, The Morning Show, Pose and Succession. An actor, Lee Jung-jae, who played the main character of Song Ki-hoon, was nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Television Series Drama. He'll be up against Succession's Brian Cox and Jeremy Strong, as well as Lupin's Omar Sy. And 77-year-old actor Oh Young-soo, who played Oh Il-nam, was nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Television Supporting Role.
That's great news. Of course, the Globes has been facing some backlash over the Hollywood Foreign Press Association's lack of diversity and ethical conflicts among its members.
That's correct. They had muted responses from this year's nominees, and American television broadcasting company NBC even stated that they're not going to be airing the Globes next year, which is breaking their 25-year run. And many top celebrities and PR firms said their clients will be boycotting the awards until they make profound and lasting change. And at this point, it's unclear who will be attending the 2022 ceremony, which has been one of Hollywood's biggest award shows leading up to the Oscars.
Nevertheless, it's a great achievement for Squid Game. We'll see if they do pick up an award or two in January. We'll leave it there for our career trending segment. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Yeowon, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you.
6 years after Cho Sung-jin made history becoming the first Korean to win the prestigious Chopin piano competition, another young Korean pianist made it to the final round again this year. 21-year-old Lee Hyuk was among 12 finalists, becoming only the fifth Korean to make it that far. While he did not win an award, his exceptional talent was on show, building excitement for his career ahead. He is currently in Russia as he attends the Moscow Tchaikovsky Conservatory, where he joins us via video for this week's Touch Basins Hall. Mr. Lee, hello, and thank you for joining us today.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Well, let's start with your start in music. I understand that you began learning a piano and a violin as well at a very early age, when you were just 3 years old.
Sure.
Do you know what led your parents to help you take music lessons? Did they see something in you, or was it something just more a part of your overall education?
Actually, I started to study music like when I was 3 years old. That was my first contact with music, so... Of course, I don't remember exactly what happened the first time, but my mom said, when I was 3 years old, 2-3 years old, when I heard music, accidentally, I was, passing by the street with my mom or playing in the playground, whatever. When I heard the music, I stopped on the road or wherever, and I was really concentrating on that music, which was playing, and my mom says I was reacting very sensitively to any kind of music, and I was really happy to listen to that music. So I was clapping or even humming, whatever. I was reacting very quickly. So after some time. My mom went to the so-called children's music play center. It was called Amadeo in Seoul, my hometown.
Mm.
And that was my first contact with musical instruments also. So I got a piano, I got access to the violin piano. So that was my start.
So that was your start. You were always, it seems, drawn to music. But when did you or your parents realize that you had a real talent for music, that this could be something that could be your future career and your future passion?
I don't know about talent, but I can definitely say that I remember the moment when I realized that it's going to be my profession. That was when I was 10 years old, I won some competition. It was called Little Mozart Competition, hosted by Tonghua Art School. Since I won the competition, I got also a special prize. So that prize was concert with Mirabel Chamber Orchestra in Salzburg, Austria. So at that age, I went to Austria. It was my first trip abroad. So I played Mozart's piano concerto, F major, I played actually in Mozart's costume, same costume as Mozart was wearing. So the audience at that time gave me a huge applause and a loud bravo. And so the excitement and joy at that time was really, I'll say, it was very hard to describe in words. So since then, I realized that playing, performing for the audience is going to be my profession, my job, because I really enjoy performing.
You couldn't describe it, but you knew that feeling. You knew you had to chase that feeling, and that was going to be your passion. I understand then that you moved to Moscow to enroll in the Moscow Tchaikovsky Conservatory in 2014. That would have made you, I believe, 14 years old at the time. Was there any particular reason for choosing to go to Russia to study music?
Yeah, I went to Moscow when I was 14 to officially, it was my birthday when I moved to Moscow.
Wow.
Yeah. And the reason was quite simple, because I really like Russian music since when I was young. Like, I'm a really big fan of Russian music. And the year before, so it was 2013, I was able to meet well-known one Russian professor from Tchaikovsky Conservatory in Austria, Berchach, the city of Austria. And he recommended me to come and study in Russia. So so I decided to study abroad, because I thought, like, Russia is culture. It has wonderful culture and very nice studying environment also. So I thought, why not go study?
Well, what was that experience moving to Russia like? Did you have any culture shock or any difficulties adapting? Did you go alone or were you with family?
I don't know. Of course, for the first time, it was kind of very different culture, but I really liked it. And I think I managed to live in Russia, like, without a big problem, quite in a last time. And yeah, we moved with my family together, with my mom and my brother.
Well, it seems like you progressed quickly there. In 2016, you became the youngest person to win the international piano competition. I'm not sure if I've got the pronunciation right, the Paderewski piano competition in Poland. And in 2018, you won third prize at the 10th Hamamatsu International Piano Competition in Japan. So you're winning all these sorts of competitions at a young age. How did you feel when you started winning these competitions? Were you always confident about your talent, or does it not perhaps feel real sometimes?
No, not I was not at all, like, confident, never, because, as you said, I was really, really young. Like, when I won Paderewski competition, I was, like, only 16 years old. I can say I was really lucky to win this kind of competition. It was really huge competition. We had four rounds there, and I was we all were performing two concertos, not one. So I can say it was such an honor. So I must say that this Paderewski competition has been pushing me since my victory in that competition to build more repertoire and to develop myself as a pianist. It's a real, really big responsibility, isn't it, to win a big competition at such a young age. So I think it was a really great lesson for me. Yeah. And speaking about Hamamatsu, yeah, it was also very big competition, one of the most well-known competitions in the world and in Asia also. So I want to say the one story that I was really shocked during my participation in this competition, because in this competition, the organizers, they make CDs. Live recording of each participant, of each performance, each round, and they sell to the audience. So it means the audience, they can listen to you or to the other participants, not only in the live, in the hall,
right?
Live, but they also buy the CDs and they can replay like a thousand times, whatever they want. So it's I must repeat, it's a very big responsibility, and it was an opportunity for me to learn that I should be deeply focused on each and every performance, on every note. So yeah, those two competitions are really big turning points in my career.
So you not just take part in these competitions, you feel the weight of these concerts, right. The responsibility that you have to back up your performances and the trust that they've given in you, I guess. Then this year came the prestigious International Chopin Piano Competition. As we've said, you've had your share of participating at major competitions, but I feel that you might have felt a bit more or a different type of pressure for this competition, especially after Chu Songjin had won the previous one 6 years ago. So were there perhaps heightened expectations? What went through your mind as you passed each round in this competition?
Many people told me like something similar because Chu Songjin was the winner of previous edition and I'm from South Korea, from the same country as him. However, I must say that it was my big dream to participate in this Warsaw Chopin competition. And I was really given the opportunity to play in the main stage in October, and even I reached to the final. So I can say that it was a really dream that came true, and I was happy to able to share my Chopin music with many audiences. So I think basically the happiness was much, much bigger. So you asked me about my mind when I passed to each next round, but it was very simple. Like I was focusing on the next round and again next round, my program only to deliver best performance for Warsaw audience, and also the audience was listening to me by YouTube streaming also.
And it's not just Chopin. In August, I understand you performed in Seoul, where you performed music by Beethoven, Stravinsky, Liszt, Grieg. So your repertoire is already quite vast, but you said earlier that you want to make it grow even more, covering different schools of music. What ambitions do you have as a musician? You've developed your talents, you've already entered all these competitions, and you're doing so much. Do you have a goal in mind? What kind of career do you want to forge?
I would say, since I really love music so much, and I really want to be a performer, I really want to be a performer who can express the many different feelings of music, because music really gives people joy, happiness, comfort, even sadness sometimes, courage, whatever. So I hope that I can continue to develop my music as much as I can till the end of my life, and my music will heal the hearts of the audience. So I want to just live as a performer who can express this feeling well. And that's all.
Well, that's a very moving and honourable sentiment. Finally, what's next for you? What are your plans next?
I can say for the next year, luckily I got a several concert opportunity after a Chopin competition. First of all, I really want to express my gratitude to many Korean audiences who were supporting me during the Chopin competition. So I got many concerts in Korea. The exact dates will be announced very soon. And also I have a tour in Europe and Japan. And the important thing that I would like to mention also is I got a chance to work with one classical management company in Poland. So I hope that I can get many concerts in the near future in Poland as well.
Well, it sounds like you have exciting things ahead of you, and I think it will be fascinating to maybe check in on you in a couple of years or so to see how you're doing. But for today, we'll have to leave it there. We've been speaking to pianist Yi Hyuk for this week's Touch Base in Seoul. Mr. Yi, it was a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
This is Matt Dalton, goalie for Anyang Halla. You're now listening to Korea 24.
We finish up the show as usual with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers here in South Korea. For that, we have joining us in the studio now our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who's been looking through those papers for us. Mark, hello. It's great to see you.
Good to see you too.
Okay, Mark, so where are we headed to first?
That would be to the People's section in tomorrow's Korea Times. Kwak Hyun-soo writes about actress Park So-dam, who is now recovering from surgery after she was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. Listeners may remember her as the crafty Ki-jung in the 2019 Oscar-winning film, a little film known as Parasite. Mm. According to her agency, Park was diagnosed during a regular health checkup. And though she had successful surgery and is recovering, understandably, she won't be able to promote her next upcoming film, Special Cargo, slated to release on January 12th.
Well, that's completely understandable, of course, as she fully deserves all the time she needs for recovery. I'm sure that must have been concerning at first. Many listeners will recognize, as you said, from Parasite, where she was best known for that little jingle that she gives.
That's right.
With Jessica, the fingers, yeah. Weidongdal, Illinois, yeah. Chicago, yes. But let's talk about this film, this upcoming film that she's involved in, without giving too much away. What can you tell us?
Sure. Special Cargo revolves around Park's character, who plays a driver for a criminal enterprise. Now, what's interesting is that Park will share the screen with Jung Hyun-jun, and listeners may better remember him as the little boy in Parasite. Mm. So Park was actually his art therapist, if you remember. So the two have actually a long professional relationship, right? Now, though Park is disappointed and she'll be missing out on promoting the film, said her agency, recovery comes first and the actress will be back to meet everyone in full health.
Yes, so we hope she has a full recovery and that she's right as rain as soon as possible. Okay, let's move on to our next story now. What do you have for us?
That would be to tomorrow's culture section of the Korea Herald. Lee Si-jin writes about the three winners of the 18th Korea Image Award, three names I think many of us would recognize. The awards were announced on Monday by the Korea Image Communication Institute.
Yes, the Institute, I understand, is a non-profit organization that promotes South Korea's image abroad, so recognizing people from various areas in Korean society. So let's hear it then. Who are the winners?
Well, first there is Hwang Dong-hyuk, director of another little series known as Squid Game. Maybe you've heard of it, Jang-ho. Of course, I'm joking. That is the Netflix original series that's just taken the world by storm. You just talked about it on Korea Trending. Hwang will be awarded the Korea Image Stepping Stone Award for helping build a stepping stone for the South Korean content to be recognized on the global stage. Mm. Next is one of the most beloved singers in the nation, celebrated soprano Sumi Jo, or Jo Sumi. She'll be awarded the Korea Image Cornerstone Award. It's for her dedication to boosting the country's image throughout her 35-year-long career. And finally, the Korea Image Budding Youth Award will be awarded to Kim Jae-duk, the Tokyo Olympics gold medalist archer and the youngest on the men's archery team. Mm. But I think a lot of the listeners, they're going to remember him for his iconic war cry, which is
fighting!
Korea, fighting! That's right. The award ceremony will be held on January 12th.
Yes, so three very worthy winners, it seems, from very different fields as well. We'll leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's where we wrap up our show for today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and we hope you have a great day. Goodbye.